Appeal number 21-1484, Real-Time Adaptive Streaming against Netflix Incorporated. Mr. Wang.
Thank you, Judge Newman. May it please the Court, Philip Wang for Plaintiff Appellant Real-Time Adaptive Streaming, or Real-Time for short. Your Honors, Real-Time voluntarily dismissed its case by filing a notice of dismissal under Rule 41A1A in the first few months of the case before Netflix answered and before a single hearing had taken place. Under the law, that dismissal left the parties as though no action had been brought. In fact, the district court here had no involvement in the case until Netflix filed its attorney's fee motion after the case ended. Nevertheless, the court found that Real-Time's notice of dismissal rendered Netflix the prevailing party and that the filing of the complaint was improper form shopping and alone made Real-Time liable for all of Netflix's attorney's fees in the California cases. Both findings were legal error and an abuse of discretion. I want to begin with the prevailing party issue, and on prevailing party, two issues are dispositive. First, because the notice of dismissal under Rule 41A1A is self-executing, there was no court order here or anything resembling one. As this court recently held in O.F. Mossberg, a dispositive issue in the prevailing party inquiry is whether there was a final decision by the court. And it noted that none of this court's precedents, including recent precedents, went so far to hold that a party could become a prevailing party without a court decision.
As I understand the district court's rationale, it's that there's something called the two dismissal rule. And under Rule 41A1B, the effect of your second dismissal, voluntary dismissal, when you dismissed the case from CD Cal, was that it operates, quote, as an adjudication on the merits. And so therefore, because the judiciary is responsible for creating, drafting, endorsing the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, that there's a sufficient judicial imprimatur through the rule itself in deeming your case as essentially having been resolved on the merits. So could you speak to that?
Thank you, Judge Chen. I appreciate that question, and I want to explain that at some length because it's very important. So Rule 41A1B does include the language operates as an adjudication on the merits, but it does not say when and how that operation occurs. And the Ninth Circuit's decision in Boeing is, in my view, perhaps the most important case, decision for this case, for this issue. It tells us exactly the answer, right? It tells us that that language comes into effect only in a third suit when a third judge goes back and looks at the claims of the first two suits and determines whether or not that rule applies. And it goes further than that. Boeing explains that in the posture of...
Is Boeing a Ninth Circuit case?
Yes. Yes, it's correct.
Which law do you think applies to the Ninth Circuit or the Federal Circuit?
Regional circuit law. And Judge Reyna, we have several cases in our briefing that say that when we're looking at the interpretation of a federal rule of civil procedure, that we apply regional law. It's not clear to us that the law would be different in any other circuit. We've seen the Boeing case repeated in various treatises in different circuits. So we don't think that affects the analysis, but we do think it's pretty clear that Ninth Circuit law applies to the effect of the two dismissal rule or
did we say something in RFR that, you know, construing Rule 41 for purposes of a 285 motion is something that's within the purview of Federal Circuit law?
I believe so. Excuse me, Your Honor. In RFR, I believe that it applied Fifth Circuit law to look at the effect of a voluntary dismissal.
What about 41? What about Minaldra-Milley? And there we held that if the Federal Circuit rather than the Regional Circuit applies, law applies in determining the prevailing status in cases involving patent litigation. So don't we have... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
This case contradicts your proposition that Ninth Circuit law applies and therefore that the Bowen case is dispositive. It doesn't seem to be the case.
I don't believe there's an inconsistency, Judge Reyna, in the following sense. The ultimate question of the prevailing party under Section 285 is a matter of Federal Circuit law. But as part of that determination, you can look at the effect or to interpret Rule 41A1B, which is a matter of circuit law. And then that goes into the prevailing party, the prevailing party determination. And I think that's what's been done in several other cases, including the RFR case that Judge Chen just mentioned. And if I may continue, returning to Boeing, when we're even looking at the two dismissal rule, like we're already within a plaintiff's voluntary dismissal under Rule 41A1A, and so the case has already ended, right? So, and Boeing contains extensive reasoning on that it is not proper when the case is ended and the parties are left as though no action has ever been brought for the district court in a collateral proceeding.
But why is it that we just cannot, what happens if we want to bundle together all of these attorney fee issues and decide them under Section 285? Can we do that?
Bundle. I think that can be done, Your Honor, but our point is that the judge does not have jurisdiction, and Boeing says this clearly, and we have not seen any case to the contrary, that the case cannot go back and make a merits determination and deem the plaintiff's 41A1A dismissal a dismissal with prejudice. And that is important because that finding made for the first time in a collateral fee litigation affects the plaintiff's claims in his complaint, right? It is a determination that they may or may not be able to refile that action. And Boeing explains why you can't do that. And the Supreme Court's Cooter and Gale decision.
Again, counsel, seems to me that Bowen law, the Bowen case is not dispositive and doesn't govern Federal Circuit law in these type of issues.
Your Honor, we do think that Regional Circuit law applies, but we don't think that Federal Circuit law is to the contrary. And Boeing simply states, and it's well supported, that issues of claim preclusion, like Rule 41A1B, must be adjudicated when that issue becomes ripe. And this court's Apple versus VoIP-PAL case is very consistent with that, right? And if I could point to something from that case, it looked at the preclusive effects of a prior judgment, right? And it held that any preclusive effects that Twitter could have against the same or other parties must be decided in any subsequent action brought by VoIPAL. Until then, any determination we make as to whether VoIPAL is claim precluded from filing an infringement action is advisory in nature and falls outside our Article III jurisdiction. And that's exactly the same point that Boeing makes, right? That in the posture of our case, we cannot assume that there's been any determination. There's no proper determination about that Realtime's claims were dismissed with prejudice or that it is not free to refile.
Let's move off this point. You don't have much time. So, I mean, we have two alternate rulings here. One is fees being granted under 285 because this is an exceptional case. And then alternatively, if that doesn't work because the other side here, Netflix, is not a prevailing party, nevertheless, the judge invoked his inherent authority to grant the same fees. Now, putting aside your argument that Judge Wu didn't exactly say bad faith, let's just assume for the sake of argument that we read his opinion as saying that what happened here is bad faith or tantamount to bad faith. So can you just get to the merits of why, in your view, what happened here, your side's conduct is either A, not exceptional, or B, not tantamount to bad faith, and thereby requiring us to conclude that the district court abused the court's discretion in granting fees here?
Thank you, Judge Chen. I would appreciate the opportunity to address that. So if we look at what was going on in the Delaware litigation in July 2019, Realtime had a pending motion to amend its complaint, right? So the case was still in the pleading stages with no discovery. It had gone on for 20 months.
I'm sorry. Before you go on, what is the current status of the Fallon patents? Are they alive or are they not alive?
Sure, Your Honor. So two of the patents that were asserted against Netflix, the 879 patent and the 046 patent, remain valid, as does certain claims of the 298 patent, which was asserted.
Are these the Fallon patents you're talking about?
The first two I mentioned are do list Mr. Fallon as the inventor.
You know what I'm talking about when I say the Fallon patents, right? There were four of them that were the subject of this litigation.
I believe so, Your Honor. But
all of the briefing keeps talking about the Fallon patents, the Fallon patents, the Fallon patents. So you know what I'm talking about.
Sure, Your Honor. I just wanted to...
What is the status of the Fallon patents? Tell it to me straight. Give me numbers.
Yeah, so two of the patents are valid. The 879 and the 046 patent are valid.
No claim was invalidated, whether it was for 101 or IPR purposes or something else.
That is correct for the 046 and the 879 patents, correct.
What about the other two?
They were invalidated in IPR.
Okay.
Not by any district court. Okay. So, and Realtime had received a mixed magistrate ruling that recommended dismissing under 101 for the Fallon patents for four patents, denied infringement for two other patents. And so Realtime looked at those events and thought that the case was likely to remain in the pleading stages because not much had gone on, and then dismissed.
Judge Connolly had made a ruling in a separate litigation invalidating five other Realtime patents. Is that correct?
Yes, invalidating patents owned by Realtime Data.
And those five patents, at least some of those, were they invalidated under Section 101?
They were all invalidated under Section 101 by Judge Connolly's oral ruling.
All right. And then at least some of those patents that Judge Connolly invalidated, real-time in this, in the Delaware litigation, pointed to as justification for why the Fallon patents are patent eligible. Is that correct?
I believe that they were cited in the briefing, and the fact that several district court judges, I think three previous ones, had had made findings that, that they were directed to patent eligible subject matter. That's correct.
Okay.
And
Judge Connolly invalidates those patents, and then the next day you dismiss this case, and then a couple days later you refile against Netflix on the other side of the country, asserting the Fallon patents and a couple others. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Well, first of all, I have to note that the Judge Connolly's order was vacated by this court, and there were many issues that were raised in that vacator order, including that.
Right now, we're trying to understand your conduct and the nature of your client's conduct when it received an adverse magistrate decision, and then it received an adverse decision by the judge on these other patents that related to the Fallon patents, and then you immediately dismissed, and then you subsequently immediately refiled against the same defendant in California on the Fallon patents.
That's correct, Your Honor. But real-time, my client's good faith disagreement with the judge's rulings that have support from this court. They're not arbitrary and capricious disagreements. They are disagreements that are validated by this court in somewhat of a harsh ruling in the real-time v. Reductio order. I think all goes to the point
I thought your argument was that this history was irrelevant. And the only history that the California court could consider was what was before him. Is that too much of a simplification?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think there's a little bit of a nuance here that certainly that there is a half dozen cases that do say that plaintiffs have the absolute right to voluntarily dismiss a case, and that implies or directly or indirectly implies the right to refile in an otherwise jurisdictionally proper venue. So certainly. But if the court is inclined to dig in...
Counsel, the issue here is not whether you have the right to dismiss a case. The issue here is whether the legal relationship between the parties changes upon, in this case, the second voluntary dismissal. What's your position on that particular point? Do you contend that the legal relationship between the parties doesn't change on that second voluntary dismissal?
Yes, Your Honor. And so those are two independent bases for reversing the district court 285 order.
But what's your answer to the question? Does a legal relationship change between the parties upon the second voluntary dismissal?
No, it does not, Your Honor. If I could turn to that briefly and give you an example. So real-time filed the second voluntary dismissal, self-executing on November 14th, 2019. On the next day, November 15th, 2019, there is no determination by anyone that real-time's unilateral action constitutes a dismissal.
In this case, does a second voluntary dismissal amount to an adjudication on the merits?
No, because Boeing and doctrines of claim preclusion tell us that question, and in particular the two dismissal rule, is not ripe, and it's an issue that can and must be decided in a third action if and when one is filed. And if a third action is never filed, that determination is never made. And no court has opined on that issue to the extent that they can. That would be an advisory opinion outside the court's proper jurisdiction.
All right. Let's save your rebuttal time, and let's hear from the other side. Mr. Gregorian.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This case was exceptional, and it was thus the type for which Section 285 authorizes a fee award. The conduct in it was egregious and also supports an award of fees under the Court's inherent powers. Realtime asserted a grab bag of patents that were facially invalid under Section 101 and some that were doubly invalid for
reasons. Mr. Gregorian, before we get to that, to qualify for fees under Section 285, you have to be a prevailing party. And now we have to understand what does it mean to be a prevailing party. And obviously the case law talks about how there needs to be a change in the legal relationship between the parties. But the case law also says that has to be marked with judicial imprimatur. That's what we said in O.F. Mossberg, and that's how I understand the Supreme Court's cases in Buchanan and CRST. So then the question is, how can we say a voluntary dismissal, even one that under Rule 41, because this is a second dismissal, says it shall operate as an adjudication on the merits. Nevertheless, it's a completely voluntary act that has no court involvement at all. The court doesn't issue an order or doesn't need to issue an order. It doesn't review the voluntary dismissal. How can we say this is marked by judicial imprimatur?
Sure. Well, Your Honor, in Buchanan, the court said the test is that there must be a judicially sanctioned change in the relationship. It also said the facts in front of it did not present sufficient judicial imprimatur to constitute that change. But here there is a change in relationship. The rule itself, adopted by the Supreme Court and enacted by Congress, says that there has been an adjudication of the claims. That is necessarily part of the judicial process.
So, you know, when I look through the Supreme Court cases and this court's cases, whenever judicial imprimatur is brought up, judicially sanctioned change in legal relationship is brought up, it's always in the context of the court doing something. It could be nothing more than entering a consent decree, but there is some judgment that is entered by the court. And so I am not aware of any case that says that judicial imprimatur extends out to whatever is said in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Is this the first case that says that?
It would be the first case that so holds directly. This court in the Keith Manufacturing case, which is 955 F3rd 936, allowed a prevailing party to move for fees after a dismissal under 41A1A2,
Manufacturing wasn't about defining prevailing party, though.
That's correct, Your Honor. So this would be the first direct holding on that question. And why we think the court should and must get there is because of the test adopted in Buchanan. The lower court in Buchanan, the Fourth Circuit, would have had the court adopt a rule that said you needed a judgment, a consent decree, or a stipulated dismissal pursuant to a settlement. And the Supreme Court did not adopt that rule. It chose this other standard, leaving open the possibilities that there are other ways that a change in the legal relationship can be judicially sanctioned. And this is, although this is a narrow, this is the overwhelming majority of circumstances in which a court case is going to be resolved, it's going to be with the judge's pen. But this, nonetheless, meets the test. And it's because the rule itself states that on filing of the dismissal, it operates to adjudicate the plaintiff's claims.
So by extension, you're saying the entire federal rules of civil procedure are marked by judicial imprimatur. They're all somehow judicially sanctioned. Whatever natural effect from any of all of these rules, those are all judicially sanctioned.
Well, so I would say it's not a judicial sanction that, say, we have Rule 26 on the books specifying discovery procedures. It just exists out there in the abstract. But Rule 41 is different. Rule 41 says that the filing of that second voluntary dismissal constitutes an adjudication of the merits, no different than if the parties had proceeded to trial. So in that case, I would say that on the filing of the dismissal, that change in relationship is judicially sanctioned in a way that's not doesn't apply to all other rules of civil procedure that are just sitting on the books waiting to be used by the parties in the court. If I could address the Boeing point, Realtime's position is basically to read that directly out of Rule 41 and say the parties are left as if no action has been brought. And as counsel told Judge Reyna, nothing has been adjudicated. That's exactly the opposite of what the rule says. Boeing doesn't apply because this court's law applies to determine a prevailing party for purposes of fee shifting. But even if it didn't, it would not matter here. All Boeing holds is the court can't use Rule 59, which applies to judgments, to go in after the fact and edit the text of a voluntary dismissal. Counsel's other point is that you don't know the exact scope of preclusion, of claim preclusion, until a third action. That is true of any case that ends by final judgment as well. You don't know the scope of preclusion until there is a later case that presents that question. But you do know who won. You do know that claims have been adjudicated in favor of one party or the other. If there's no further questions on prevailing party, I'll move to why this case was exceptional. And that's because this was an abuse of the court in Delaware and California. Realtime litigated in Delaware for more than 20 months. A final judgment of invalidity was imminent.
This is you're getting ready to address the conduct of, involved here. I'd rather hear a little bit more on some of the other issues that we have raised, like the district court's finding of the sanctions based on Rule 11. Is that appropriate?
So the district court sanctioned Realtime based on its inherent authority. And we've argued that that is entirely appropriate under the John Acreage case, which was affirmed by the D.C. Circuit, where a party engaged in similar sort of behavior. They had an adverse ruling in front of the first court. They went to a state court to try and get a different ruling while that first ruling was on appeal. And the defendant was forced to remove the case back to federal court, which the plaintiff resisted, and then transfer it back to the original court to get the judgment to which it was had already established it was entitled. And that's the same sort of conduct here. The case was imminently going to be resolved by adoption of the magistrate's recommendation on 101. That would have undercut an entire litigation campaign. Keep in mind the broader context is that Realtime had sued scores of companies on these same patents in different forums, and this was going to bring it all to an end. And so they dismissed and refiled in California, and they told the California court that they had done so because the Delaware court had not ruled fast enough and had not moved the case along fast enough. They had never asked for a scheduling conference, and they had been content to wait for months until they knew that they were going to lose. And so we think that meets the facts of John Eckridge, and it's well established that the court can use its inherent powers to control that sort of behavior. Now, Realtime has argued that the court cannot do so, or did not do so properly here, because it did not say that it had acted in bad faith. But the cases are clear in the Ninth Circuit that those literal words do not have to be recited in the opinion to support a finding of sanctions under the court's inherent authority. There just has to be, from the record, conduct that is tantamount to bad faith. And here, I think that is very clear from the record. If I could circle back to the argument about Rule 41, that Realtime was entitled to engage in this behavior because Rule 41 permits it. If you look at the cases that they cite on that, none of them have anything to do with the conduct that Realtime engaged in here. The case it relies on in its opening brief, City Trends, a Fourth Circuit case, is simply a declaratory judgment plaintiff and another declaratory judgment defendant racing to the courthouse. And they're each free to choose their forum. That is forum shopping in a colloquial sense, but it's not the type of forum shopping that have it here, where Realtime invoked the powers of the Delaware court for 20 months and then ran away when it lost. Similarly, the Walters Kluwer case from the Second Circuit, that just shows Rule 41 as it is intended to operate. There, the plaintiff filed in New York. The defendant said, there's no personal jurisdiction in New York, but there is in Massachusetts. And so the parties dismissed and refiled in Massachusetts. And the first court in New York decided to examine the circumstances and motives of the dismissal and decided it was for an improper purpose, to cover up malpractice and sanction that party. Rule 41 working as it's supposed to. Everyone agreed it was... The first court was the wrong forum. They dismissed and went to the second forum. And the holding of the Second Circuit was that the first court can't inquire into the motives of the dismissal. Here, this is not the Delaware court sanctioning Realtime for leaving the court. It's not for the dismissal, and it's not imposing restrictions on the refiling in advance. It is at the end of a case after the second court has finally resolved the action, looking back and saying, on the totality of the circumstances, was this case exceptional? And that is why the Rule 41 cases that Realtime applies just do not bear on the subject before the court. If I could address the cross appeal briefly.
Yes.
This court's standard, to the extent it has adopted one, is that administrative proceedings at the PTO, fees for them can be recovered under 285 if those proceedings substituted for district court litigation on all issues considered by the PTO. This court in Monolithic Power Systems, VO2 Micro in 2013, did not state that test, but applied it effectively the same. It allowed a party to recover discovery fees from a related ITC proceeding when everyone agreed that that discovery was going to serve as the discovery process for the district court litigation. Applying that standard, Netflix was eligible to seek its fees for the IPR. And that is because, as the court knows, IPR estoppel is now quite broad. Filing those IPR petitions,
Mr. Gregorian, the district court said that even if Netflix is eligible to recover fees for IPR proceedings and the Delaware civil action, in the judge's view, the facts and circumstances didn't warrant granting fees for those proceedings as well. So, again, that's a... It's a very deferential standard of review we have here in reviewing that and how the judge found the true misconduct was chasing after Netflix in a brand new civil action and hitting the restart button in California. And that was the problematic activity, not necessarily that it was so unreasonable for the plaintiff here to defend its patents in the IPRs or to the way it defended its patents in the Delaware litigation. So what was so unreasonable about that view of the case by the judge?
So, Your Honor, that view is not unreasonable, and I concede that the judge on remand may reach the same result. It's just since we're on an abuse of discretion review, the question is not whether the record would hypothetically support an exercise of discretion that the district judge has not made yet. It's whether the judge's actual exercise of discretion was based on the law with no errors embedded in it. And here, the court said it was unclear whether IPR fees were eligible, but its alternative ruling was that under the Federal Circuit's case in Munchkin, and I'm quoting here, it would be error for it to award the attorney's fees for the litigation that occurred in the Delaware action or in the IPR litigation.
Well, what about at A14, where the judge said at the bottom, even assuming that it is within the court's discretion, the court finds that such an award is not warranted here. As the court noted earlier, it does not find Realtime's decision to file the Delaware action an untenable one.
Right, and
the conduct the court found exceptional was Realtime's decision to voluntarily dismiss the Delaware action only to simultaneously file the California actions with most of the same claims.
So to be clear, it's in your view, the actual filing and existence of the California action is quite significant in terms of the cross appeal and with respect to the going back retroactively to the Delaware action and to the IPR. Is that accurate, that the very fact of the refiling in California shed a new light on these prior practices?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's, in the first instance, we argued below that these patents were facially invalid and that the claims were baseless when brought in Delaware. But yes, accepting the district court's finding that the case became baseless once it was brought in California, I do think that had an impact on whether the IPR fees were recoverable. Netflix was forced into a position where it needed to defend itself via one procedure or the other. And at a certain point, the case became baseless and it still needed to incur fees. I would also say that the determination under 285 is based on the totality of the circumstances and as to the whole case. And that determination at least authorized the court below to consider the earlier fees from Delaware and in the IPR. But it's clear that if you read the section that Judge Chen quoted in combination with the section that I quoted, that the district court thought it was not authorized. It couldn't award the Delaware fees or the IPR fees without running afoul of Munchkin. It needed to find baselessness from inception. And that's just not a formal requirement that this court has. The court, as I said to Judge Chen, we don't dispute that if the district court considers this based on the correct legal standard for an award of IPR fees and this court's case is under 285 and comes to the same result for similar reasons, that would be a proper exercise of discretion. It's just here that there are two errors baked in. One, determining that it's uncertain that IPR fees can be ever recovered. And number two, ruling that it had to find baselessness in Delaware if it was going to award them, which, again, it said it would be error for the court to award without that finding.
Okay, we'll save your rebuttal. Let's hear from Mr. Wang.
Thank you, Your Honors. I have a few important points on the prevailing party issue and then on the conduct inherent powers. So it is, even assuming that the second dismissal created a change in the legal relationship between the parties, which we strongly dispute, the existence of a court order is an independent requirement. And it's an important one, stemming back to Buchanan, where it, as a matter of statutory interpretation, looked at the meaning of prevailing party and found that it is one who has been awarded some relief by the court. And when something is a court order, particularly if it pertains to affect a party's substantive rights, it can be important that it's appealable. If real-time files a notice unilaterally, that's not something that can be appealed. And then we have Mr. Gregorian and me debating what it means or the effect or when it comes into play. That needs to be decided by a court and be appealed for there to be a determination of real-time's rights. And in that sense, it's akin to what we were talking about this morning with IPR estoppel under Section 315E. Netflix happens to be estopped from challenging two of the patents that were asserted in the California cases or the Delaware cases, right? But this idea that Section 315E itself changes Netflix's rights today is not quite right. We need a determination by a court. If there is some future litigation where Netflix is found to infringe and their only defense is based on invalidity and a printed publication, there needs to be a court decision making that finding and giving that order judicial imprimatur. It can't be that a rule itself promulgated by some judge or judges since 1934 constitutes the type of judicial sanction that this court's and Supreme Court precedent has consistently required. My second point on the prevailing party is I would really call to Your Honor's attention footnote 7 of Judge Wu's order on Appendix 25 to 26, where he ruled for the first time that real-time's dismissal was an adjudication on the merits and was with prejudice. That ruling is impossible to reconcile with Boeing, and it's also inconsistent with Cooter and Gell, right, which says that in an attorney's fee collateral proceeding, the one thing that the court can't do is affect a party's legal rights, right? That would be an advisory opinion. And there's a part of Cooter and Gell, which, by the way, dealt with the court's authority to impose Rule 11 sanctions or contempt sanctions, which it can do anytime. It can do 5 years after the fact. And Cooter and Gell held that even if a district court indicated that a complaint was not legally tenable or factually well-founded for Rule 11 purposes, the resulting Rule 11 sanction would nevertheless not preclude the refiling of a complaint. So in an attorney's fee order, judge who can't go back for the first time and make a determination that, by the way, real time, your unilateral notice of dismissal more than a year earlier, by the way, that was with prejudice. And by the way, no one told you, no person has ever said so, but over the past year, real time, you were not free to refile the complaint. And then the final point on prevailing party is that real time can file at least another case based on the 879 patent that was in the second case. And Netflix even agreed to that. In the attorney's fee briefing down below at Apex 3636 at footnote 5. And that's a further fact that contradicts any notion that and that the district court was wrong to rule that the dismissal was with prejudice. On conduct and inherent powers, I want to be very clear what we're saying and what we're not saying, right? An improper purpose is filing a case for the purpose of harassing your opponent or for the improper purpose of bankrupting your opponent to gain an advantage in the marketplace. That is improper, right? But it is not improper if your goal is to gain an advantage in a litigation under the rules that the rules allow. Avoiding a possibly worse verdict and getting increasing your odds of a better verdict, that is not the type of improper purpose that courts have found that do warrant Rule 11 sanctions. And we would submit that is the most that Judge Roop possibly found, that it is not bad faith to your client walks into your office and asks, how can I stay within the rules and increase our odds of ultimate success? And following the rules to increase your chances in a litigation is not hiding malpractice. It is not abusing the judicial process, and courts have universally held that.
Well, what they say is that the purpose was improper, not because real-time withdrew when it started to become clear that it was extremely likely they would receive an adverse judgment. The improper purpose was the refiling of the same case in another forum to try again.
Well, Your Honor, being able to voluntarily dismiss your case and the Beechuk case cited in our briefing and other cases that address voluntary dismissals make the same point. And there are many cases where the defendants oppose a voluntary dismissal that have gone far more advanced than our case, that included trial, included the end of discovery, far, far more. And the argument is always that allowing this dismissal will allow the plaintiff to form shop and to file a new action. And so that comes directly from being able to dismiss your case. And that conduct is expressly contemplated by Rule 41D, that you can refile some of the same claims in a new action, which is further support that this is not an abuse of the judicial process or something sanctionable, right? So beyond the pale. But Your Honors, my final point on the inherent powers is that we cite like several cases in our yellow brief on pages 25 through 27 that directly supports us on the inherent powers point and exceptionality, including Walters and the Adams case, where in those cases there were specific findings, more specific and more improper findings of improper purpose from a voluntary dismissal for the purpose of form shopping. And the courts in those cases, the Second Circuit in Walters and the Eighth Circuit in Adams, found that it was an abuse of discretion to so hold. Finally, the John Attridge case is just distinguishable. And it goes to my point about, in that case, the plaintiff, their second suit was barred. There was a final judgment. That was an illegal action. They were not following any rules. They were breaking rules to do so. And so because of that, there were specific findings of bad faith in that case. Here, there's no dispute that Real Time was not allowed to file the second case, and no specific findings of bad faith, which must be proven by clear and convincing evidence, which we don't think that either Judge Wu made or has any support in the record.
Okay. Any more questions for Mr. Wang? All right, then you have the last word, Mr. Goyal, on the cross appeal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to honor the court's rules concerning rebuttal. I don't believe opposing counsel addressed the cross appeal in his remarks. I would just conclude by saying I think it is at best unclear the basis for the district court's purported exercise of discretion to deny the IPR fees. And under this court's law, that uncertainty would support a remand for the court to clarify whether it would do the same under the correct legal standard. If the court has no questions, we'll submit.
Okay. Any questions, Mr. Ugarte? All right. Our thanks to counsel. The case is taken under submission.
The Honorable Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.